The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Thank you all for coming. I'm sorry about the confusion about the room. Apparently there was a class there. They didn't know about it when they gave us that classroom. It's my pleasure today to introduce Victor Moscati, who's here on business, and he was kind enough. He was here at a meeting for the World Bank, and he was kind enough to decide to agree to come and visit us and give us his thoughts on the WTO and developing countries, perspectives on the impact of the WTO agreements on national legislation and development. I think Victor is well suited to this task, and we are very much looking forward to a discussion following your talk. Victor spent his time, he's worked at the director, he's worked in the secretariat of the appellate body of the WTO, and has helped appellate body members with writing on advising them on their on the decisions that come up on at the appellate body level. He has worked for a very well known international NGO called International Center for Trade and Sustainable Development. And that organization also works very closely, it monitors very closely developments at the WTO, and advises also governments who are members of the WTO, and has worked with the African countries in that organization, and now he is a legal officer at the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, and he's been in that post since 2003. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce Victor and have him.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I guess I'm sort of tied to this thing, so I don't know whether it's better to stand or sit. Yeah. Okay. Great. Okay. I guess I don't need this. Well, it's really a pleasure to be at the American University today, and I want to thank, first of all, Professor Ali for very kindly agreeing to host me, and of course, Professor Bradlow also for the invitation to begin with. One of the most vexing issues that you hear mentioned in the WTO is with regard to developing countries. A lot has been written about it, a lot has been said about it. There have been entire negotiations devoted to the issue of developing countries. But then again, when you look at it very closely, you don't see much movement in terms of a real shift towards addressing the problems the developing countries face in the WTO system. And of course, this goes back to the days of the GATT. The issues were very much the same. The concerns of developing countries have remained sort of unchanged. And the solutions provided have also remained more or less the same. But besides general issues to do with the difficulties of developing countries in the world trading system, my talk today is going to focus sort of on narrower issues, somewhat focusing on the linkages between national law and international law in the broad spectrum of things. So you can see I was a bit in a struggle to find a topic that would be most appropriate for a talk like this. So I ended up with two different topics that maybe overlap in some way, depending on how you look at it. But the main thing to remember is that I want to talk about the impact of WTO agreements on national legislation. That is, what do countries do once they have signed those agreements in Geneva? What do they then need to do at the domestic level in order to meet or comply with the obligations that they have signed themselves up for in the WTO? You could broaden this up a little bit and say, what really is the impact of international law on domestic legal systems? That is a broader question, but I think the particular character of WTO agreements is such that they require very specific changes to domestic legislation. Now, as far as I know, there has not been any real comprehensive study on, you know, what really happens when countries need to implement those obligations. There's not been a compilation or a matrix of sorts that sort of puts down, you know, ideas on what has country X done about agreement, the agreement on sanitary and phytosanitary measures. Okay? So I begin from that premise that there is some kind of vacuum in the existing literature on what it is that countries do or what it is that countries have done in the last 10 years regarding the agreements they have signed in the WTO. Okay, so by way of introduction, I know that Professor Alai has taken you through what, at least most of you, through what the WTO is all about, so I'm not going to spend time on that. But let us say that, first of all, the WTO as a whole has within its administrative mandate about 14 substantive agreements. Now, substantive agreements here is, of course, subjective, but these are what, in my view, would be the main agreements that the countries are supposed to implement in the WTO. In addition to that, there are about 50 odd others, you know, decisions, understandings, declarations, that have some sort of legal value, but then that do not invite immediate obligations for countries to implement. So, first of all, there are these 14 agreements, and these 14 agreements, each one of them has immense obligations, and those obligations could be, you know, what we are going to talk about. They could be in terms of, they could be obligations that require certain legal changes. Now, the WTO is quite a huge organization, 148 members to date, with 31 other countries in the process of wanting to join the WTO. So what you have is an organization that's going to be, you know, in terms of membership, at least very close to what the UN's membership is, 180, 190 countries, practically the whole world. And the only key countries that are missing there, key in terms of their volume of trade, would be perhaps Russia, which is currently in the process of accession, Saudi Arabia because of obvious reasons, oil. Even though oil is not within the agreement, the commodities that are administered by the WTO. And there are a number of countries in Africa, in the Pacific, in Latin America, that are in the process of accession. Now, what are the main commitments that the WTO invites countries to follow? There are many, but you could broadly categorize them into, you know, commitments regarding tariff reductions. So countries gather around at the end of the Uruguay round, 1994, they say for trade in agricultural products of this nature, we are going to reduce our tariffs by a factor of X. And they all agree to do that, and they do it. So the implementation of that is fairly straightforward in my view. But then it goes a little beyond that. It says, you know, you could reduce tariffs with respect to particular agreements, but with respect to agreements like on trade-related intellectual property rights, you would have to come up with legislation that requires you to protect plant variety rights. Or you would have to extend the term of a patent from whatever it is that you have to a minimum of 20 years. So if the law for a particular country provides for a patent for a maximum of 15 years, you see already that there's going to be an immediate change to that particular legislation. Now, what about legal reform? You know, this means that there are commitments that cannot be met simply by, you know, tariff reductions. There are commitments that require certain positive action on the part of the countries. And those are broadly what I call legal reforms. Of course, legal reforms here means, it could mean changes to existing domestic law, changes to, you know, regulations or other subsidiary legislation. It could also mean repealing certain laws that prevent, you know, certain objectives of the WTO from being realized. So let's think about legal reform in that broad sense. So in the past decade in which the WTO has been in existence, there have been a lot of changes that have been made to the country's domestic laws. I venture to say that it's possible that, I could be wrong, but it's very possible that there is no international agreement, no international organization that has resulted in such extensive changes to domestic law like the WTO has in history. Now, the nature and extent of those changes is, of course, also quite broad. You have, you know, reforms ranging in coverage from the agricultural sector to finance, telecommunications, to stock markets or equity markets, and so on and so forth. But the overall impact is that it comes down to what do countries want to do once they engage in economic liberalization. For many developing countries, I would venture to say, it's all about development. What do they want to achieve at the end of the day? They want to be able to improve the livelihood of the people. So then it comes down to what is the impact of all of these reforms, legal, administrative, and so on, to the ability of countries to achieve their goal of development. Now, let's step back a little bit and say a couple of remarks as to why it's important to look at this impact. So in a broad sense, you could say that, you know, what we're trying to look at is the impact of WTO agreements on national legislation and by extension on development, because legislation is, it doesn't just remain in the books. It's got to be enforced. It's got to be implemented. That means you've got to come up with institutional structures that can enable you to implement or enforce legislation. So, first of all, economists tell us that there are certain welfare gains that are going to be obtained from economic liberalization. Whether or not you believe that, I think, is beside the point. The issue is that there are certain changes that result as a result of opening up markets. If you have an economy that is closed today, like many countries that were in the former Soviet Union, and you open them up, suddenly you're going to see a change. First of all, in countries that I'm familiar with, for instance, in Kazakhstan, it was illegal for any foreigner to own land. All that a foreigner could do was to have a lease, okay? And there was a maximum number of years within which somebody could hold a lease of land. But now, because of changes to the economy, foreigners can own land. That means investment. So you are definitely going to see some changes. But in terms of quantifying all of those gains, you are not properly going to be able to do that unless you also add in this legal component to it. You look at how many laws have been changed, with what effect, what institutions were created as a result of those new laws. What institutions had to be reformed? What about, you know, the administrative changes that took place within the institutions, whether or not they were existing or they were new? So you've got to have that broad spectrum before you can be able to properly put a figure to it like economists do. Then secondly, after a country joins the WTO, there are a lot of other things that need to be done, whether voluntary or not, to the economy. First of all, they are going to require that, for example, the taxation of foreign enterprises be done more or less, you know, in a non-discriminatory manner with domestic enterprises. So all of those sort of trade facilitation measures that will be done within the country after accession to the WTO or after coming into force of the WTO agreement, then you've got to know what legal reforms took place in order to effect those changes. So it's an important exercise also in that respect, particularly at the domestic level. And thirdly, it's useful information for countries that are in the process of accession, because you're not going to join an organization unless you know what it is you're up against. What is it it's going to require you to do to your laws once you join? So you find this question very common amongst the countries that are in the process of WTO accession. They say, what will we be required to do once we join? So studies that capture the entire spectrum of changes that are expected post-accession would be useful for countries like this. And it will also be useful to, it's sort of a fortuitous addition of my own, that it's useful to international organizations when they are providing advice to these countries. It's good to know what it is they have done, what it is other countries have done, for you to be able to properly provide the advice or assistance that's needed. And it's also useful in terms of conducting an analytical survey of the legal impact for the country itself, even in the long term. There are countries like China that took advantage of WTO accession reforms to reform also the entire legal system, or most of the legal system, most of the laws that were existing. So they took advantage of the requirements of the WTO to make changes to other laws or other parts of the legal framework that are not even required by the WTO itself. So, okay, so there are a couple of questions that we need to bear in mind. First of all, because they form sort of the basis for this discussion. And those include things like, you know, if you are carrying out a survey of the impact of WTO agreements, you've got to look at what is the current national legal framework that you are looking at before joining the WTO, before the coming into force of the WTO, and after. If there is a change, then that change is going to be either associated with the WTO or associated with some other different obligations. So the idea is that to narrow down the search for this impact to only those changes that were brought about as a result of some or other WTO agreement. And here you could talk about, you know, the national legal framework in terms of agriculture, in terms of intellectual property rights, in terms of sanitary and phytosanitary measures, and so on and so forth. I have a heavy bias towards the impact on the agricultural sector simply because I work for the Food and Agriculture Organization. Then you've got to look at what are those international instruments that give you the obligations that countries then have to grapple with. And here you're looking at, you know, the WTO and related instruments. You're looking at all of the agreements that I mentioned, the 14 substantive ones, and probably those others that are within the book. And then how are those international instruments translated into domestic law? Do they always have to be translated into domestic law? Do you always have to take a particular agreement? Let us say the example of the TRIPS agreement, the agreement on trade-related intellectual property rights. What does it require you to do? Does it say that, you know, you've got to incorporate it into your domestic legal system? What is it that the domestic legal system requires you to do in order to translate those agreements into domestic legislation? How are they enforced? What are the penalties for non-compliance? So you've got to go through all of these questions in your mind before you can properly do an impact study of, you know, international agreements on national legislation. Now, we have heard this over and over again, I'm sure, that WTO agreements do not exist in isolation. Okay? They exist within the broader spectrum of international legal obligations. Okay? This is as much agreed in WTO case law as it is in scholarship. So you have binding obligations and you have non-binding obligations. WTO agreements, of course, fall within that category of binding obligations. And under binding obligations, you have certain human rights treaties, certain bilateral investment treaties, certain environmental agreements, intellectual property agreements, and so on and so forth. And WTO agreements sort of fall within that category of international legal instruments that require mandatory compliance. And then there are non-binding ones. Good examples might be, you know, the World Bank guidelines on investment. They're nothing more than guidelines, even though they have assumed such a force of authority that, you know, certain countries just take them as as law. And then there are international principles like, you know, those that arose from the Rio Conference in 1992. Those are principles, but that are widely accepted. At the end of the day, they remain non-binding. Okay, now what is the role of the government in terms of implementing WTO agreements? So we have sort of looked at the spectrum of WTO agreements, what it is they require countries to do. So at the end of the day, it is the government which is charged with the responsibility of implementing these agreements. It's not the private sector. Okay? The buck rests with the government to do something about it, because the government alone has legislative capacity. So, first of all, a government has the responsibility to draft and implement effective legislation. Effective here could mean any number of things, but I take it to mean, you know, laws that are actually implementable in the sense that they have precise obligations and they have some sense of penalty in the event that you do not comply with them. And they have a responsibility to ensure that, you know, there's some kind of safeguards in the event that there is, you know, importation of food or other types of products into a country. And they have a responsibility to control, you know, domestic and foreign trade. So they come up with laws and regulations on what, on the right to trade, on who can trade, who can incorporate a company, and so on and so forth. These are the roles of government. But all of these obligations are impacted upon by sovereignty concerns. I know it's a big thing in this country. And what you have is that alright, so you have on that left-hand side there the international legal processes that give rise to international obligations. So here we are talking about negotiations, we are talking about the results of those negotiations, that is, the international instruments. And in that category you could put all of the non-binding and binding instruments that we talked about. And then on this side you have the national priorities, what it is that the government wants to do. So you see that reflected mostly in Congress or parliaments. You see that reflected in civil society concerns. You see that reflected in private sector concerns. So all of those would qualify as national priorities. And then you have some policy space in there. So that circle there talks about the ability of a government to adapt whatever is coming from the international legal process into its national priorities. So how much that flexibility, how much of that policy space exists is an issue for debate. But once you put those processes together, you have the international legal processes and the national priorities, they come up and they sort of coalesce in domestic law. So the extent to which domestic law is able to relate national priorities and international legal processes is, of course, an open question. But then again, once the law is passed and it's subject to implementation by the competent or implementing authorities or agencies. So the key thing to remember here is about policy space. Because one of the big arguments you hear in the WTO, particularly regarding developing countries, is that they say there's not as much space for us to formulate our development priorities. The WTO is imposing things on us. The international legal process is imposing things on us. They don't want us to do certain things so that we can develop. Take the example of investment. Developing countries, most of the arguments that have been advanced against a multilateral agreement on investment, both at the WTO and in other fora, is that there's not as much capacity to direct an investor into a particular sector, into a particular disadvantaged location, so that development can be seen to have occurred. So that issue of policy space is something worth keeping in mind. So what are all these obligations that we are talking about in the WTO? There are many obligations, but you could broadly categorize them into, you know, perhaps supply-side obligations. Those are obligations that require, you know, the WTO, I mean, they require a WTO member to take certain actions, say, to make sure that the MFN is obeyed, the most favored nation. That means do not discriminate between products that come from different countries, or national treatment. That means, you know, treat foreign products alike, regardless of the country of origin, and so on. So these are obligations that are contained in the WTO agreement that are sort of basic. And I call those the supply side. And then you could have requirements like in Article 11 of the GATT that requires that you eliminate or reduce all forms of quantitative restrictions. So these kinds of basic obligations that apply across the board are one category of obligations that arise from the WTO. But, you know, these are not really things that you would open a statute book and find, okay? At least not in the language in which they are rendered in GATT Article 1 and 3 or 11. These are things that are reflected in the daily administrative practice of most countries. Of course, in some countries you find legislation that has, you know, all of these things as they are written in the GATT. But in most countries, at least in the ones that I'm most familiar with, you do not find that reflected in national legislation. What happens is the customs officials, when they have a product coming in from country X and country Y, they are not allowed to apply a differential tax treatment. They're supposed to treat them the same if they are like products, at least. So it becomes very much an administrative issue, something that is applied at the border by the customs agencies. And then there's the other side, which is the more positive obligations, which require countries to actually do something. And this I call the consumer side because they're more directly applicable to the recipient, that is the consumer. So what you find is that these are obligations that require, you know, for example, that country X might say, unless we know that your food or the product with which you made your food comes from a disease-free area, we are not going to allow you into our market. That is perfectly legitimate because it falls both within the exception under GATT Article 20 and also under the SPS agreement. So it becomes something that is a positive obligation on the person that wants to access your markets to comply with. Okay? And then, you know, there are other obligations like inspection of particular products prior to marketing. There are, you know, things like the requirement to maintain pesticide levels at a certain minimum, or sorry, at a certain maximum for you to be able to sell flowers or roses to a particular market. Once we go through your flowers, the consignment, we should not find pesticides left in there to a certain maximum. And if they go beyond that, then, sorry, you don't have any right to access our market. So those are obligations that, at the end of the day, they come down to the private sector. Okay. Now, there are a number of problems with implementing these types of obligations. Okay, both the basic obligations like GATT Article 1, 3, 11 and so on. There are other obligations, like we have said, the more positive ones that require countries to do something. But there are many, many problems. First of all, you have problems to do with import licensing. In many countries, you are required to have a license in order to import certain products. Now, for you to move from that regime of requiring an import license for any importer into one that is completely free and open to everybody, you run into all sorts of problems. First of all, the people that have the import licenses could be state trading enterprises. It could be the government itself. So if you move away from that regime in which imports are controlled to where they are freely open, then you run into problems because you are going to affect government revenue if it was a state trading enterprise. You're going to have to put in place certain measures to make sure that whoever is given the license is actually using it in the right way. But what the WTO says is that as much as possible, any non-tariff barriers should also be removed. Now, an import license is a non-tariff barrier to trade. so it ought to go. But in fact, many developing countries run into practical problems in enforcing those kinds of obligations, partly because it's tied to government revenue, it's tied to effective mechanisms of control once you fully liberalize, and so on and so forth. In Seychelles, for example, there's only one company or one corporation that's allowed to import foodstuffs. It's a state trading company. Now, what happens if Seychelles joined the WTO today? It's not a WTO member yet, but it's thinking about it. It's in the process of accession. What happens? You open up. And what happens to this giant state corporation that is charged with importing all the food that everybody in Seychelles eats? I don't know. So it's questions that have huge implications in terms of the provision of government services, the economy as a whole. Services, you have a lot of problems regarding particularly capitalization requirements for banking, insurance, and so on. What happens is that certain countries, because of existing laws, prior to the coming into force of the WTO, they require banks to have a certain minimum of capital before they can be licensed to carry out banking services. Now, if you impose these obligations on foreign banks that want to do business in your own country, then you run into the problem of MFN, or national treatment. You're engaging in discriminatory treatment between the nationals who want to engage in banking services, who are subject to those laws, and the foreigners who would like to do the same thing. And intellectual property rights, this is a huge area, very fascinating area in terms of the scope of coverage. It's everything from patents, copyright, industrial designs, geographical indications, plant breeders' rights, and so on, with huge implications on agricultural productivity, on the economy as a whole. And so, given all of these problems that countries face in adapting international obligations to the domestic situation, I wonder what it is that, you know, countries need to do. I guess in implementation per se, the only thing that the first thing that governments ought to do is simply, you know, review the existing legislation and draft a new one if the existing one is not properly compliant with the WTO or with the relevant WTO agreement. So you start off by some kind of extensive review of the existing legal framework, and then look at ways of updating it in keeping with the obligations that arise from international commitments. Ultimately, therefore, what you have is, you know, either constitutional reforms, for example, in China, that was part of the changes that took place, and in Sudan, that is also the case right now, even though it's not joined, but it's the process of accession. And then you have, you know, lesser legislation which, you know, would demand changes to existing law or the drafting of new laws or the repeal of certain existing laws, all with a view towards complying with those obligations that arise from the WTO. And then the last category that I have there is institutional and administrative reform. This is more or less routine. Although, in fact, in the literature now, you have, regarding non-discrimination, that is GATT Article 1 and 3, there's what some scholars call de facto discrimination, and which is sort of discrimination that arises not because of any particular provision in the law, but as a result of, you know, administrative practice. So it is possible that administrative practice can be challenged, even though it's not provided for in legislation as such. Now, just a quick point about joining the WTO. One of the things you hear expressed by many countries that are in the process of accession is that, okay, besides the huge obligations that would be placed on them as a result of accession, first of all, they say the accession process is a lawless process. And the reason is that, you know, there's only one provision that talks about accession in the entire framework of WTO rules. That's Article 12 of the Marrakesh Agreement. It says, you know, that a country will join the WTO on terms to be agreed. So that leaves it very open as to what demands a country would come under in order to be able to join the WTO. So you can see that it's very much an open question. What legal reforms a country will be required to undertake prior to joining the WTO could be included in there. What, you know, economic policy changes would be required to be done, administrative requirements, and so on and so forth. So it becomes very much an open question as to what a country would be required to do, both in terms of the legal framework and in terms of the policy and the rest of it. So much so that you have, from one extreme, countries that negotiate accession to a point where they are actually ready to negotiate, and then they back off and say, hey, I think the demands are too much, we have given too much, we are not interested anymore. Vanuatu is one example of a country that went through the entire process, but then realized they had given too much, and probably it wasn't really feasible that they would be able to comply with all of those demands that they had responded to, and therefore they gave up the process. And in the last of the two countries that joined the WTO, that is Nepal and Cambodia, I seem to recall that the extent of legal reforms that they were required to undertake was such that it would take a lot of assistance before they are able to fully comply with those, and I'll mention that in coming. So, of course, what we're saying is that accession implies a lot of changes to the domestic legal system. And that is a very broad question. It's broad in terms of the sectoral coverage of those reforms and also in terms of their impact. And then there's this classic provision here in Article 16 of the Marrakesh Agreement that says that once you have come up with those laws, once you have joined the WTO, you're required to conform. Okay? So each member shall ensure conformity of its laws and regulations and administrative procedures. So that's a clear requirement that is there, that, you know, it's not just talking about what you're going to do, but what you will do also to ensure that conformity is obeyed. So what you find is this situation where countries are, you know, drafting new laws left, right, center. You have Nepal, which, and by the way, these are only agriculture-related laws, except China, which I think is a case that you cannot really, I don't know if it's representative of anything, but so you have Nepal, which had to review 64 agriculture-related laws. The FAO was actually involved in that process in Nepal, and also in Sudan. Kazakhstan, we came quite late into the process, but the reforms are still ongoing because Sudan, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, they are still in the process of accession, but the nature of the accession process now is that you're required to almost comply with the commitments that you have made prior to joining, which was unlike the case for the countries, including the US and my own country, which joined in 1994, for example. They had some kind of transition periods for many of the developing countries that joined at the time. For example, in intellectual property rights, you could say, okay, you have 10 years within which you have to fully comply with this particular agreement. So that kind of transition period. Now, some of these countries that are in the process of negotiating right now, they do not have that luxury of transition periods if they are unable to negotiate. If they are able to negotiate a transition period within the protocol of accession, then it goes as part of the obligations. But if they are not, then, you know, the implication is that they have to conform immediately after accession. So, and then you have Azerbaijan with 15, Namibia 32, and China with that many. This, of course, includes local government, provincial regulations, and so on and so forth. So it's a different picture, I think, from what you would find elsewhere. So what in sum, what we're saying is that the impact is quite broad in terms of sectoral coverage. You know, it's everything from the impact on state trading enterprises to, you know, sectors of the economy. Its impact on the private sector, everything from contract farming to telecommunications. Its impact on the judicial systems, for example, the TRIPS agreement requires that, you know, you've got to have due process. If you infringe on my patent rights, I've got to be sure that you will give me due process for me to be able to litigate my rights in your courts. So it requires the government to take that positive action of ensuring that there's a right to judicial process. And its impact on legal reforms and on administrative decision-making. But who is offering the legal assistance that these countries need? This is an open question. Again, there are many, many organizations that are doing it, individuals as well. The thing is that much of this assistance is not of very good quality, especially in, for example, in Eastern Europe, where we've done some work. The problem is that you have lawyers trained in a common law approach, and they are drafting or assisting countries of a civil law tradition, and there are problems of language. If you're not Russian speaking, it's very difficult to know what other laws there are that touch on the issue that you are drafting legislation upon, and therefore how does the law that you draft, how is it going to fit within the rest of the legal structure? So you find inconsistencies because of these kinds of problems. But, of course, it's up to each country to request assistance from whoever can give it, if it's USAID or the World Bank or the Food and Agriculture or the WTO itself. The WTO itself does not give any legal drafting assistance. It's quite hands-off in terms of what it can do. Or bilateral donors, or even individuals. Some law professors are actually famous for drafting legislation for some countries. And in practical terms, therefore, there are very few good options in terms of, you know, the legal assistance that's available to especially developing countries and also economies in transition. So most of the legal assistance is quite sector-specific. So if I go into a country and I'm assisting with legislation on intellectual property rights regarding plant varieties protection, I might not be able to appreciate the full scope of related legislation that I ought to look at in order to ensure that the whole thing is integrated. So you find that sector-specific approach makes problems in the long run to show up in these countries. So I wish to end there, except to say that, you know, I've sort of run through a lot of issues, which I hope at the minimum, you will reflect upon as time goes. Thanks.
Thank you. Sure. Thank you. I can now to questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Level of economic development, assistance and their obligations should be commensurate to their level of economic development. There's all this, and the special differential treatment language has always been in the gap. So the question is, to what extent does that come in, and to what extent it helps countries in that Christian process, and how can it tactically can be used, number one.
I guess, excuse me, the problem with FND language is that, first of all, it's legally unenforceable, most of it at least. And secondly, it's not crafted in the manner of a legal obligation as such. It's merely aspirational. So much of the technical assistance that developing countries should receive is really on, I venture to say, it's on a voluntary basis. And it does not, it's not the kind of assistance that, you know, is complying with the agreements is not predicated upon receiving assistance. So there is a distinction there that, you know, it doesn't say that unless we get technical assistance in drafting, you know, the SPS implementing law, we are not going to, the obligation is there to comply. So except for very clear provisions like transition periods, where it says that developing countries have 5 years to implement this particular agreement, then that you could say that, you know, before the end of the 5 years, you know, there's really no one could challenge you if you do not implement before the 5 years. After the 5 years, it's a different story. But for anything that has to do with, you know, capacity building, technical assistance of any sort, I think it's aspirational and therefore legally unenforceable. It becomes beneficial when it's used in negotiations, not in a legal environment. In negotiations, particularly when there's strength in numbers and sort of consensus amongst developing countries, they could say, okay, we are not going to agree to this proposition unless we are guaranteed that there's going to be technical assistance of this and that kind, okay? Whether it's financial, whether it's, you know, knowledge-related in terms of seminars and workshops and so on, whether it's, you know, equipment to set up a laboratory to test, you know, food safety-related issues. So, how much of the technical assistance is practical?
You know, in negotiations, you know, did you have an experience regarding that, for example? Okay, these countries, the living countries, I don't know, the Jordan, or we are going to negotiate, or just we are going to give this nuclear, or this, I don't know, this petroleum device. Okay. If you would like to join them,
Here's what happens. An accession negotiation takes place in a room no different than this, okay? People are sitting around, and the country that wishes to accede makes a proposition, okay? It says, we have done ABCD in terms of wanting to join the WTO. And then they could, at that forum, request for very particular assistance. They could say, in terms of food technologists, we have only two in our country at PhD level. And for us to properly do food testing and therefore comply with the SPS agreement, we need 40. And country X could say, we are going to train two. Another country could say, we will give you laboratory equipment. Another country would say, and then it's up to them to bilaterally follow up. And so it sort of goes outside of the WTO as an administrative mechanism. It becomes more of a bilateral. What remains multilateral, on the other hand, is assistance that comes through the fund, the joint. There is a fund that sort of provides resources for workshops. That's really the only thing that remains multilateral.
Problems
either in terms of technical, scientific, legal capacity to implement any of these reforms. And some of the options available would require much more than the countries are capable of, or quite frankly, they may have corruption problems. How do the countries make the decision about how to implement, given the wide range of choices that are available to implement outside the context of the accession negotiation, once they're actually trying to make the choices?
It's very much an issue of, you know, that's within the sovereignty of a country. So what they do at that level, you know, outside of what they have agreed to within the WTO is really, it's the kind of reach that the WTO does not get into, okay? And as a matter of fact, any other international organization. But having said that, I think, you know, there's any number of factors that influence the decision to implement in a certain fashion. First of all, let us take the example of, SPS, the Sanitary and Phytosanitary Measures Agreement. What are the ways of implementing that? It's through, you know, first of all, provide the rights and obligations in some piece of legislation, and then after that, develop the institutional structure that supports the compliance with those rights and obligations. So you're talking about the technical side, which would be, you know, the laboratories, the testing facilities, and so on. And then you're talking about the judicial process, which would enforce those rights and obligations. Now, I think that at that point, advice from either donor countries comes in as a factor. You know, if a country requests for assistance from USAID, then, you know, there might be in that package assistance coming in terms of expertise, in terms of actual people advising the government on what to do. There might be, you know, equipment coming in and so on. So it's really an open question as to what factors influence that kind of decision. Of course, prior examples might help. But I'm hard-pressed to think of any other. I don't know if I answered you. But do you think that sounds like what you had in mind?
It is. I guess my one question is the real politics of the international system and when the countries are better off undertaking law on the books that they know they can't implement versus trying to actually adopt a system that they might be able to implement.
Well, there's this always a gap, okay? There's always a gap between what is in the statute books and what is enforced or applied every day. I think even with the best of intentions, it's hard to really comply with even voluntary legislation that a country comes up with. Often it has to do with responding to pressure of some sort. And I do not rule out corrupt practices somewhere along the way. But, I would agree that there's always, you know, that disconnect between what is in the books and what is actually enforced in practice. Even in mundane things like agricultural laws. You know.
What is the value of the country in developing countries? What did they negotiate for developing countries? Get out of it in the accession negotiation. I don't mean LDC, which is designated by the UN.
Right.
Because I understand that what was one of the points for Saudi Arabia, like to be a developing country. And why? I know that the Kyrgyz Republic, and I was told, didn't ask to be called the developed country. They thought that was beneath them or something.
Yeah.
So what is the value? If you see a value in, is that an issue that because it by itself doesn't create, they would have to negotiate further things, or does it by itself give them special?
I would say both. By itself, having the status of a developing country, which is, by the way, a self-selection criteria, any country decides to call itself developing. By itself, it has certain advantages in terms of implementation periods, for example. So, like in the agreement on agriculture, it says the commitment to reduce subsidies for developing countries is supposed to be within a period of 10 years. For other countries, it's 5 years, something like that. So that is an immediate advantage. But having said that,
now you're in 2006.
What happens now is that you know, implementation is deemed to have taken place, at least unless there was an extension of the transition period, which was the case, for example, in intellectual property rights. But what happens now, the real advantage to having developing country status is the negotiation. Okay, you could say, like China, that we are still a developing country, okay? We need certain concessions. I hesitate to give specific examples, but there are concessions that are obtainable simply by having that criteria of being a developing country. There's some clout to it, I would say. Whether or not it's real clout in terms of, you know, achieving real results is another thing. But there's also a bit of solidarity in it. You say you're a developing country and you're Brazil, then you have the other developing countries who will back your position when you need it, you know, even if it's a self-seeking kind of demand. So, I would say, yeah, there's some advantage to it. Legally speaking, of course, as I said, much of the special and differential treatment provisions that are special to developing countries or to least developed countries are, you know, of very little real value. I don't know much about economics, enough to say at least that it could. Anecdotally, I would say probably ruin, I don't know, but affect, yeah. You know, the issue of subsidies is quite complicated. There are, first of all, in the WTO agreements, there are various categories of subsidies. Okay, there are actionable and non-actionable subsidies. The actionable ones, of course, are illegal. The non-actionable ones are allowed. So if you are giving subsidies for research and development, those fall within the allowed, you know. So joining the WTO and having these subsidies in place for research and development, I think it doesn't affect anything. But having export subsidies, giving subsidies to Honda to export in order to get the market for motorcycles is another thing, okay? And the reason is that that is distortive of the market. It sort of creates unfair competition on the part of Honda. So I think there's a certain value to having those rules that try to equalize the market. Now, how they are applied, in fact, is, of course, another thing, because, for instance, in in the cotton subsidies that are given by, you know, many developed countries, the thing is that what those subsidies do is that they create an artificially low price for wild cotton. And the producers of cotton, who are, you know, the less costly producers, they lose out, because what the subsidy does is it evens out the price. It makes sure that even if you're a low-cost producer, you sort of, and you should be selling at this point, the high-cost producer, because of the subsidy, can sell at this point, so you're at the same level. So the competition is quite stiff for these people who are producing at low cost and should therefore actually be the market leaders.
Low cost meaning the ones with lower wages.
Right. More. Probably. Yeah. Yeah. So there is some sense in having, you know, rules, WTO rules that try to make sure that, you know, this unevenness of the market is fine now. Okay.
Wondering how a country's regional trade obligations and some sort of regional trade agreement, if they conflict with the WTO obligations, what takes precedent, or is that sort of situation arising?
Yeah, what happens is that the GATT Article 24 has very precise rules on what countries should do in the event that they join regional trade arrangements that in some way, you know, conflict with WTO obligations or the multilateral obligations. First of all, because the existence of regional trade agreements themselves are an anomaly. Because what is the effect of having a regional trade agreement? Like NAFTA, for example, what it does is it privileges the trade relations between those three countries that are within NAFTA. And the basic idea behind the WTO is that there should be no privileges, okay? Treat everybody the same. Have, you know, if you're having trade relations with Canada, have the same kind of relations with Kyrgyz Republic. So the existence of regional trade agreements in themselves are sort of an anomaly. But in there, I can't quite remember offhand what the obligations say, but there are certain obligations that require that, you know, there ought to be some balancing out in the event that there is some kind of conflict. And the existence of organizations like NAFTA or agreements like NAFTA is that they are an exception rather than the rule. So Article 24 is really an exception from this no privileges kind of multilateral trade agenda to an exception for regional trade agreements. So it's really an exceptional situation that is treated as such in according to the rule.
Well, I think it begs the question of what's going to be the WTO's relevance if all these regional trade agreements are being signed. I think recently there's a commitment to, by 2020, to have an Asian free trade bloc. What's that going to do to the credibility of the WTO? Is it going to be looked at the sidelines and regional negotiations come first? Or is it going to look at the WTO as the main thing?
You could look at it two ways. First of all, you could look at it, you know, the way you seem inspired to look at it, as some kind of competition between, you know, the regional trade agreements and the WTO. In which case, then you could say that, you know, if you have so many of these things, then perhaps one day the WTO will become irrelevant. But the other way to look at it is that, you know, if you take the evidence of some of the agreements that are being signed now, is that they actually have higher obligations than those that are contained in the WTO agreements. So they might actually result in a ratcheting up of, you know, the whole liberalization exercise, in which case then the multilateral process also gains, because that's the basic idea of it. So,
sanctions in the event that the later and fine regional
I believe there was one case between Turkey and the European Union in which I think it's one of those issues that until a dispute actually comes up and then you see what the dispute settlement system does to this, yeah, so it's really, you know, so yeah, it's an open question, I guess.
There's no other international organization that has imposed such great obligations on an internal, so maybe intrusive, in the internal regulation of a country, beyond the field of what you generally think of as trade, export-import.
Right.
I mean, you've got, you know, patent law or intellectual property, domestic, every part of domestic legislation. And it really has envisioned, I think, a particular view of the state. And a regulatory state, which may not necessarily be the way countries have evolved.
Yeah.
And I think it's an open question, but you sort of have to look. There's all this transparency in Article 10 of the GATT.
Right.
There's all this transparency requirement of the GATT, which says, which values procedure a lot. And we Americans are familiar with that. We like that. Everybody has a procedure, has to be published, everybody has to be able to see it, even though nobody reads it, but it has to be out there. And the question is, to what extent is that vision of that mystery state the one that we're going to have for everybody, and how is it going to, you know, I don't know how you would enforce it, but I see that as being one of the biggest legacies of the WTO, if everybody successfully implements it.
True. I would agree that, you know, perhaps that's the one of the more successful outcomes, I guess, of the WTO, that there's a lot more openness now, even in countries where you would not be able to know the kinds of legislation that they have. As a result of those obligations that they have to send copies of legislation to Geneva. And even though it's in original language, then you could struggle with translation. And also the, you know, even the revisions of amendments to these laws also have to be notified and so on. So that notification function, I think, I quite agree, is really revolutionary, maybe. Yeah.
And the role of lawyers is becoming increasingly important. What we didn't address is, how did you end up where you are, and how did you
long story.
How did you end up getting a job at the WTO, and what did you do?
I don't know. Well, the short answer is I was an intern there, and then ended up there.
So if you guys have any questions,
you have 2 minutes after. Yeah, you need to run.
So I thank him very much.
How do I do this now? Sure, I'll be.